From a researcher's crawl through the bogs to a fast trip through the trees, this is the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan, and today we have the latest on tiny turtles in our region's wetlands.
Sticking out, you see her tail right there, in the back end of her shell.
As well as a visit to one of the newest zipline courses. Plus, air pollution is particularly harmful to more people than you might think.
It's diabetics, it's people that are probably obese, it's people with genetic polymorphisms.
Please stay tuned for this and more on the Allegheny Front. Zip lines use pulleys, cables, and good old gravity to provide a fun way to explore the outdoors. Zip line courses have been developed around the region. One in North Park near Pittsburgh just opened. And for this story, West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Beneduccio reports on a zip line at West Virginia University's Morgantown campus.
The first official person to use the zip line was the school's mascot, the Mountaineer Jonathan Kimball. Wearing a special coonskin helmet, he thoroughly enjoyed the experience.
Let's go!
A zipline is an aerial apparatus where a pulley is suspended on a cable, and it is mounted on an incline. They are designed to enable a zipliner propelled by gravity to travel from the top to the bottom of the incline cable. The zipliner does this by holding on to the pulley. WVU's zipline course stretches along part of the university's research forest near Cooper's Rock State Park in northern West Virginia. It's a place where students, faculty, and others will be able to go and not only enjoy the experience, but do research and learn more about scientific and mathematic concepts. Greg Corio, director of Adventure West Virginia, says this is truly a unique program.
We see each platform as a classroom connected by zip lines. We intend to use these to help our participants have a different view of the natural environment. It's the first time you can move from the base of the tree up into the crown, and you're going higher as you go down. You're going to look at the forest from the top down instead of from the down up. So it's a completely different perspective.
Ziplining is an activity that's gaining a lot of interest in West Virginia. Along with the WVU course, there are zipline courses at the New River Gorge and Harper's Ferry, to name a few. Corio says the WVU course will be used to prepare for activities at the Summit Bechtel Reserve Camp near Beckley. That's the spot which will host the Boy Scouts and its Jamboree later in July.
Because of the need for trained operators at that facility, this will be a training facility that will train WVU students that will have an opportunity to go down there and help operate that facility. And so it's because of that coming to the state that we have this opportunity.
The recent grand opening of the zipline course brought scores of enthusiasts to the site. WVU President James Clements was one of them.
We want to be a leader. We are a leader. This place is spectacular, truly spectacular. If any of you are looking for me in my office and one day you can't find me and I'm having a real stressful day and I want to get away, I'm coming here. I'm coming right here.
The course includes four zip lines, an aerial bridge, and a rappel station to exit the course. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beneduccio in Cooper's Rock.
Let's go!
You're listening to the Allegheny Front. Thanks to West Virginia Public Broadcasting for that story. Please go to AlleghenyFront.org for a listing of other zip lines around the region. Now, from zip lining to a much slower and lower exploration of our natural world, it's time for Wild and Seek, the Allegheny Front series featuring interesting animals, plants, and habitats in our region. We're looking at how these parts of our wildlife are faring in a changing environment, and today we're looking at America's smallest turtle, the bog turtle. Its population has been reduced by habitat degradation and poaching, but now it's getting some help from some of the largest wildlife agencies in the country. Here's the Allegheny Front's Kara Holsapple.
A few years ago, the Allegheny Front followed George Gress of the Nature Conservancy as he followed a bog turtle, Well, he was really following the turtle from afar. The critter was outfitted with a radio transmitter.
She should be right down in there. She definitely knew if she's out there now. There's her antenna. You can see her antenna there.
The animal's movements were slow. These are turtles, after all.
Sticking out there. You see her tail right there in the back end of her shell. And there's the... She hissed a little bit.
Gress and volunteers were tracking the turtles to learn what they were up to in the open wetlands they call home. It's not easy. Gress calls bog turtles secretive, and they're small, just a few inches long. In the summer, waist-high grasses make them almost impossible to spot. Gress says the biggest threat to bog turtles is a loss of wetlands. That loss comes from all the usual suspects, housing developments, and roads that separate small turtle populations from each other and limit their travel to reproduce. These days, Gress's team is back out in the bogs, doing more research. They'll be in the field through next month. Early one morning, before he headed out, he spoke with the Allegheny Front on the phone. He had some good news already.
One of the populations that we were studying has over 200 turtles, and so that's probably the highest population of turtles in their northern range.
In another location, Gress says his team unexpectedly found their monitored turtles on a patch where a farmer was growing hay. There, Gress was able to make recommendations on management based on previous research.
The local farmer was mowing the field, and we changed the timing of that mowing so that it would be done when the turtles were not using the field.
Gress will have more support for working with landowners thanks to the establishment of a new federal program, Working Lands for Wildlife. About a dozen of the farmers and landowners Gress works with have signed on. The new program is a partnership between the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It provides funding for wildlife managers to advise and help make changes on properties that favor bog turtles and other threatened species. Landowners could even receive up to thousands of dollars an acre for designating easements on their properties, areas where they pledge not to disturb turtle habitats.
We have guided some of the landowners that we were already working with that may have been a little bit hesitant. They weren't sure of, you know, what was going to happen with their wetlands, or you know, they weren't sure about what they wanted to do with them.
Gress says the new program will make a big impact. Most bog turtles live on private land. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Carol Holsapple.
That story was part of our series Wild and Seek, in which we find and profile cool animals, plants, and habitats in our region and consider how these elements of our ecosystem are doing in a changing environment. This coverage is funded by the Richard King Mellon Foundation.
Often when we report on air pollution, we point out that it's especially toxic for vulnerable people like the very old or the very young. But this week at an asthma summit in Pittsburgh, Ron White from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health said pollution can cause serious problems for most of the rest of us, too.
We're understanding more information about who else is at risk. It's not just sick people. It's not just people that have acute, very serious heart disease and respiratory disease. It's diabetics. It's people that are probably obese. It's people with genetic polymorphisms that make them more at risk to air pollution. There's stress. Dr. Schwartz talked about some of the studies that have been done in Boston on air pollution and stress. Nutritional status also affects your ability to fight air pollution.
White recently completed a report for the Heinz Endowments called The Health Impacts of Pittsburgh Air Quality. It reviewed scientific studies from the last 30 years. The Heinz Endowments is also a major funder of this program, the Allegheny Front. Other speakers at the asthma summit shared data about the link between air pollution and things like low birth weights and even stress. A few of the experts said the scientific community has finally reached consensus that pollution really is a health problem. Francesca Domenici, a biostatistician with Harvard's School of Public Health, explained this in a panel discussion.
12, 13 years ago, there was a lot of skepticism about health effects of air pollution. And if I think about my own career, it's been really to work toward this issue. And it's actually incredible, not only my own experience, but if I think about a lot of my colleagues, there has been really change in understanding the effects of pollution.
Domenici said that the transition of scientific thinking is now focused on which regulatory measures work best. Joel Schwartz, professor of environmental epidemiology at Harvard, has been working in the field since the 1980s. He said that all we need to do is summon the political will to put controls on all power plants and diesel engines, and the technology is available now.
And not doing it, you know, is the equivalent of withholding medication from people who need it to save their lives. I mean, it's not something that we would do there, and it's not something we should do in this case either.
Yet it's clear that despite a scientific consensus on the importance of preventing air pollution through power plant scrubbers and other means, industries and many politicians are not on the same page as those at the asthma summit. The Environmental Protection Agency has met with big resistance in trying to enact tougher air pollution rules. And just a couple days after the air summit in Washington, all of the Republican members of the Senate Committee for Environment and Public Works skipped a confirmation hearing for the EPA's new secretary, Gina McCarthy. She currently heads the EPA's Air Pollution Office, and environmentalists see her as having a strong hand in that department. Links to the study by White, as well as other information from the summit, are at AlleghenyFront.org. We've heard a lot about animals and plants shifting habitats to deal with climate change. What if the effects of climate change actually forced you to leave your home? Researchers around the world are exploring how severe climate changes may be increasing the rate of migration. The Allegheny Front's Ashley Murray has been investigating the immigrant experience as it relates to the environment in an occasional series called A New Natural World. She has this story.
The man whose voice you hear is speaking in a cafe in a Pittsburgh suburb. He won't reveal his name or exactly where he works for fear of immigration authorities. He says he was a farmer in Chiapas, a state in southern Mexico. Now, a translator explains the man, who's in his 50s, works cleaning movie theaters.
Long ago, we were able to plant more, but now the corn doesn't grow as much and it's more of fertilizer and the land doesn't provide as much as it used to.
He says he left Mexico to find work in the U.S.
I love my family and my wife very, very much, and it's hard to be here without any physical contact with them.
This is just one person's account. And for a century, migration for economic opportunities has defined Mexican culture. But a 2009 study found that things like increased hurricanes, tropical storms, soil degradation, and deforestation have factored into Chiapans' decisions to leave. The study by the Environmental Change and Forced Migration Scenarios Project was funded by the European Commission. Researcher Elizabeth De Giza says evidence supporting climate-induced migration in Mexico is growing. De Giza co-authored a new report called Climate Change and Migration in Mexico. Here she is speaking at a panel discussion in February at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C.
The environmental changes continue to affect Mexico. The average temperature is expected to rise up to 4 degrees by the end of the century. And the same goes for the average precipitation that is expected to decrease by 11%.
De Giza says these kinds of long-term climate changes can affect a family's access to food and work. This is especially true for weather-sensitive jobs like farming. Mexico is just one of the countries where researchers are examining connections between climate change and migration. The United Nations University's Institute for Environment and Human Security, along with CARE International, a non-governmental organization, have studied the ways climate change might impact populations in 8 countries. These include Bangladesh, Peru, and Ghana. Coco Warner, one of the study's researchers, found that while wealthier families can use migration to diversify their livelihoods, poorer families usually can't.
What we were concerned to find is that when they have trouble with the weather, they also use migration. But they do so in ways that erodes their base.
For example, in places like northern Ghana, an area highly dependent on rainfall but experiencing erratic seasons, heads of households are leaving during growing season just to take a chance on finding money elsewhere. Still, How climate influences a person's decision to migrate is a tough thing to dissect.
We have to acknowledge that it is not always easy to distinguish the climate impact from economic pull and push factors.
That's Michael Wirtz, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. He studies the way climate change, migration, and security intermingle. He says his organization is talking to countries about what exactly to call people in this situation. Environmental refugees, climate migrants, etc. And then, once the name is decided, what rights should protect them?
This is absolutely still an emerging field of research, but if you take a step back and you ask yourself, should we be concerned about these issues from a policy standpoint, then the answer is a resounding yes.
Some estimates say that worldwide, tens or even hundreds of millions might have to move across borders or internally because of severe climate changes. But the U.S. is less likely to see an influx of its neighbors. The big issues will likely be within U.S. borders. That's according to Jeff DeBalco, a policy researcher at Ohio University's Voinovich School of Environmental Studies.
Climate change impacts in the United States have big implications for economics, for agriculture, for jobs. I think most of those are impacts that would be felt here in the United States and might be separate from questions of cross-border migration.
Vulnerable coastlines, fiercer fire seasons, long-term drought, and insects are among the effects that could force people to move from region to region. For now, though, the U.S. is proving more profitable for the one-time farmer from Mexico.
I want to be here maybe one more, 2 more years, but when I lived in Florida, that's what I said. It's been 8 years now, so only God knows how much time I'll be here.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Ashley Murray.
Many crops, especially fruits and nuts, depend on honeybees to pollinate their flowers. New estimates from the federal government shed light on the growing crisis of the loss of honeybees from what's known as colony collapse disorder. The Allegheny Front's Hal B. Klein has more.
New estimates put bee colony losses at nearly 38% last year in Pennsylvania. A preliminary estimate released this week indicates that this year's bee colony loss will be even more severe. Stephen Rapaski is president of the educational beekeeping group, Berg's Bees. He says that declining bee populations have serious economic consequences for Pennsylvania farmers.
You're looking at millions of dollars lost in revenue from the lack of pollination of crops. People are looking and scrambling hard to rent bee colonies in order to get the pollination that they need.
Until this year, colony collapse disorder was a problem that mainly affected beehives in the countryside. After this winter, things are different.
A lot of urban and suburban beekeepers lost a good number of their hives. You know, you're hearing reports of anywhere from 50 to 70% loss in some areas.
A recent USDA EPA report cites a variety of factors for bee decline, like a parasitic mite, lack of genetic diversity, and poor nutrition in honeybee colonies. The EPA says that further studies are needed to prove that pesticides are dangerous to bees. According to Rapaski, the need to fix the problem is urgent.
We're in trouble, and I believe we're in crisis mode already.
So the next time you see a bee buzzing by your head, think twice about swatting it. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Hal B. Klein.
Hops are happening. As craft brewing has taken off, it's created an opportunity for farmers to get back into growing the crop. Central New York was once the dominant grower of this key ingredient of beer. Innovation Trail's Ryan Delaney visited some upstate farms growing the crop now.
Is this all yours up along the road?
Yeah, up to where the field ends.
Dave Pasek moved back to his family's farm just north of Utica a few years ago.
What I wanted to show you is this circle here is the old foundation to a silo.
And growing around the silo were wild hops.
And they were all over. They were all over the barn. And we were like, oh man, those are hops.
So last summer, Pasek strung some ropes up to the side of the barn so they'd grow. On a chilly, damp morning, he's climbing up the side of the old barn, tying more rope for the hops to grow along. Hop vines grow up to 18 feet in a year, producing flower-like cones. They're added to brews for bitterness and flavor. Pasek has transplanted some of those wild hops and is working on a trellis system to expand the farm. Hop farming right now is more a hobby, but he's glad to be back on the land that's been in his family for decades.
I guess in practice, yeah, I'm a brand new farmer. But I don't know, it's in my blood, so I think I'll figure it out.
Pasek's farm turned out about 5 pounds of hops last year. He was able to sell them to the Saranac Brewery down the road in Utica for a special fall beer using all local hops. Pasek outspent what he received for that crop, buying up bottles of Saranac's wet hop brew with his hops in it. Saranac is just one brewer turning to local farms to find ingredients, and that relationship between brewer and farmer is poised to grow. When the state legislature passed a bill last year to support New York's burgeoning craft brewing industry, it put in requirements about the ingredients brewers use. In order to qualify for the state's financial incentives, brewers must get 20% of their hops in-state. That requirement will eventually rise to 90% by 2025. A century ago, Central New York produced the majority of the nation's hops, but by the 1950s, hop growing had moved to the Pacific Northwest. While most hops are still grown out there, Steve Miller, an expert on the plant with the Cornell Cooperative Extension, says hops in New York are making a strong comeback, thanks to people like Pasek.
If you can imagine saying all of a sudden somebody invented strawberries and everybody in the state wanted to grow, have a strawberry farm, That's essentially what's happening with hops.
Miller says a decade ago, there were only 10 acres of hops being grown in New York. By this summer, that will have increased tenfold.
This is what we classify as a hill, and it has a crown in it. And the crown's right below here, and you can see the shoots coming up here. There.
On a foggy morning, Larry Fisher is showing me around Foothill Farms in the Madison County town of Munnsville. These early shoots will be cut back to encourage the growth of stronger vines. By the end of the summer, they'll tower above on a network of ropes. Larry and his wife Kate are now some of the more experienced hop farmers in central New York. They began planting hops in 2001 after Kate became fascinated with the plant. Being amongst the first to start growing hops again, Kate says they had to adapt some of the early advice they got.
We planted things too close together when we started. The rows were 7 feet apart based on our readings of hop history and not thinking that a tractor is a little bit wider than a horse. So
the Fishers now grow several varieties of hops on about 7 acres. Come August, the Fishers will harvest the hop vines. They'll cut down the lengthy plants and run them through a harvester that Larry built himself. These hops grown in New York will end up in local beers on tap a few months later. I'm Ryan Delaney for the Innovation Trail.
Please go to our website, AlleghenyFront.org, to learn about an event next month in the Lake Erie region, bringing together hops growers from Pennsylvania, Maryland, and New York. And from farms to much less spacious growing spaces like porches. Our Organic Gardeners installment this month provides ideas for containers and specific plants to grow. Here they are, Jessica Walliser and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette's Doug Oster.
I'm Doug Oster from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette for the Allegheny Front here with our organic gardener, Jessica Walliser, and just not everybody has a big garden space to plant in. Let's talk about growing in containers.
So a lot of people think of container growing as strictly ornamentals. You know, they'll grow some petunias and some geraniums and ivy in containers on their patio or on their back deck, when in reality, it's very, very easy to grow a lot of great vegetables in containers as well. You just have to kind of be smart about the varieties you choose, be smart about the soil, and be smart about the containers that you're using to grow them in.
But you have to choose the right plant for the right container.
You absolutely do. And I think we should probably start with what it means to have the right container, because this is where a lot of container gardeners go wrong. They start too small on the container. You cannot grow a full-size tomato plant in a little 18-inch pot. Really, for vegetables, the bigger the better as far as containers grow. And one option I think that people really should look at are some of the eco-friendly containers, some of the ones that are made out of recycled materials, recycled nursery plastic. I love some of the containers that are made from rice hulls, compacted rice hulls, pots called cow pots that are made from dehydrated cow manure. Now, you might not want to have those on your patio or deck, but they might be a good choice.
No, I do want to have that on my patio. You do want to have that on your patio. That sounds
great. Yeah, they're really interesting, and they only last for a year or two, and then they kind of naturally decompose. So looking at containers like that is a great place to start.
What's the best way to grow a tomato in a container?
Well, I think that you're really going to want to examine the type of growing media that you're using in that container. You want to use an organic potting soil. Never use soil straight out of the garden because it's too heavy and it can contain some pathogens. So you really want a nice, light, soilless potting mix. Obviously, you want to choose one that's organic. And you're also going to want to look at that label as well and really try to find one that has nutrient sources already within that soil mix. So you want to see things like, you know, dehydrated poultry manure and alfalfa meal and kelp meal already mixed into that potting soil so that you don't have to be feeding it all the time throughout the summer months.
And what kind of container for a big plant like that?
Well, for a big plant like a tomato, you really want to do a minimum of 5 gallons. I say even, you know, 8 is even better. But not just that, also the variety of tomato matters. You know, you're not going to want to pick a variety of tomato that's going to get, you know, 6, 8 feet tall and grow it in a container. You want to choose appropriate varieties.
So when I'm at the nursery, what am I looking for?
Well, you're going to want to look for something called a patio or a bush type tomato. This is not such a big issue when it comes to a smaller plant like a pepper or a cabbage. You know, pretty much any variety of those are going to do okay in a container. But a substantially sized plant like a tomato, you're obviously going to want to go with a patio type or a patio variety. You can also look a lot of times in many seed catalogs and local nurseries will have dwarf varieties of plants. So they'll have something like an eggplant called Fairy Tale, which is one of my favorite miniature eggplants. It only grows to be about 18 inches tall. And the fruits themselves are smaller, so they're perfect kind of single sized portions. And they would be a really good choice for container vegetable gardening as well. You know, smaller carrots, like the round carrot. There's one called Romeo that's short and squat and round. And that would be an excellent choice for containers.
Well, how about vine crops like cucumbers or squash or something like that?
Yeah, they can be really aggressive when grown in a container. I mean, if you're going to grow a full-size cucumber variety in a container, you better have like railings for it to trail, you know, the vine to trail, because they can go 10, 12 feet out. But there's bush cucumbers, bush squash, bush zucchini. Those are the varieties that you want because they're going to only form a compact plant but still have just as good production.
Well, tell me all about self-watering containers.
Yeah, if you're really concerned about using a lot of water on your container gardens, you might want to consider self-watering containers. And these basically are constructed in a way that they have a reservoir underneath the pot that holds water. And then there's sort of a wick, a fabric wick that goes up out of that reservoir and into the soil and therefore into the plant's roots. So as long as there's water in that reservoir, your plant is always going to have the exact level of moisture that it requires.
Containers are a great way to grow vegetables no matter where you live. I'm Doug Oster.
And Jessica Walliser.
For the Allegheny Front.
Well, how does your garden, whether on the porch or in your backyard, grow? We've got a cool little video on our Facebook page from our new social media editor, Carol Holsoppel, about how she got a little green with envy over a neighboring plot at her community garden. Check it out on our Facebook page and add your own photos. Thanks for listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. Janelle Pfeiffer is our production director. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. Please visit our website, where you can now make donations to support our programming at AlleghenyFront.org. And join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on The Allegheny Front.
The Allegheny Front is supported by the Heinz Endowments and the A.D. and J.W. Wilson Fund of the Pittsburgh Foundation.